From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
This week on the program, we're going to step out of the classroom and hear from experts who provide support to students in schools through nutrition service, transportation, and parent groups who help make a difference at the school. Joining us will be Allison Sayre, Director of Food Service for Fraser Public Schools, Laura Smith and Kelly Johncox from Warren Consolidated Schools Department of Transportation, and rounding out the program, we'll chat with Julie Drummond and Carrie Bouchain from PTOtoday.com. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now is Allison Sayre from Fraser Schools, the Director of Food Service. Welcome to the program, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
As part of our show today, we're continuing to focus on all of the non-instructional support that are provided to students and staff in schools. And obviously, nutrition is a substantial one for many, many children. And I think a good place for us to start is, how does Fraser Schools and your team approach supporting the health and well-being of students throughout the district?
A couple things that we do. We have regular wellness committee meetings, which is something where we coordinate with parents, district staff members, nurses, coaches, administrators to collaborate and talk about what initiatives we can plan and we can take and kind of run with. We also focus on education, promotional materials, what kind of signage we have in the buildings. And we want to make sure that the message we're sending to our students is a positive one, that physical activity is important, eating healthy is important. And we also put up signage that reflects the meals that we have. So we want to advertise to our students what a nutritious meal looks like.
Mm-hmm. And that really speaks to your commitment to helping them eat a well-balanced diet. And I know the USDA has particular standards, and this really is separate from the current debate over whether lunches are going to be funded and so on. But just the basic premise of how you make sure a student receives nutritious meals, from an operational perspective, what does it look like during the day, say in a high school cafeteria? What kind of measures do you take to make sure students have the right kind of stuff in front of them?
Well, I mentioned signage. That's really important. But we also know that not every student's going to look at the signage that they see. So first, it starts with us and educating our staff. So the staff need to know what makes a healthy meal, what components we're providing, and what components they need to take. And then we need to share that communication with our students and parents. Because if parents know, they can have those conversations with their kids. Like, make sure you're taking a fruit or a vegetable. This is what's offered. We put it on our menus, but we also need to have those conversations. And a lot of students are very visual, meaning if they walk in, what they see is what they're going to eat. So having those fruits and vegetables be front and center is really important.
Yeah, there's an old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You ever heard that?
Oh, yeah.
It really is, to your point, it's one thing to put the food in front of them. It's another thing to work with them to understand, and their parents and so on, to understand the benefit of it. On that note, do you take any particular steps to help students with dietary restrictions or allergies?
There is a big emphasis on allergens. You know, we see a lot more now than we did, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So we are provided resources as a district from the state that help us to provide meals that are safe for students. So the first thing that we really encourage is that parents communicate with us. So that can be a special dietary needs form if they're requesting accommodations. Then what we do is we take that information, we share it with our staff, have conversations about what appropriate substitutions are. We plan a menu or meals that are safe for those kids to eat. So we I personally review all of the special dietary needs forms that we get, and then I communicate with our nutrition staff to make sure they're comfortable and are aware of what students can have. Mm-hmm. We keep food separate. A lot of stuff that we serve, especially for like breakfast and snacks, is portioned and wrapped, which really helps immensely because you're not worried quite so much about cross-contamination, mm-hmm. but we always focus on that, especially with lunches where we're preparing food.
It's a very good point, and I know the classic example is the peanut allergy, which has been a challenge in schools for a long time. We're currently chatting with Allison Sayre, the Director of Food Service for Fraser Schools. Allison, does your experience tell you that good nutrition and food service support for students correlates into what we would consider our positive outcomes for learning and behavior in schools? What's your experience?
Absolutely. I think that sometimes people take for granted that kids are going to get a healthy and nutritious meal. It helps them to focus. We have found that kids having a nutritious full breakfast, you know, milk, fruit, grains, whole grains especially, will keep them focused throughout the school day. And having a nutritious lunch to keep them fueled and focused in school keeps them on task. If they're hungry, they're not thinking about their next meal. We know that they're getting the nutrition while they're in school. And there's things that we do to help to make sure that they're getting those things. All kids go down to the lunchroom for the most part, and then serving breakfast in the classroom so that that meal, especially at the elementary level, is front and center.
When a child comes to a cafeteria and they see the food prepared for them, and many of them don't have an understanding of what has happened behind the scenes.
Right.
You know, we all know about the staff who work in the lunchroom for a couple hours a day, mm-hmm. and so on, but there is an entire operation behind the preparation of the schools. And could you walk our School Talks listeners through what a typical day is for your staff in terms of meal preparation all the way up to the service line at lunch? Not necessarily breakfast, but what does the day look like all the way up to serving lunch?
You know, that's a good question, because for a lot of our staff, you don't realize that their day starts at 5 in the morning, and that's just to get ready for lunch. So we send food to all of our elementary schools. So that's fresh salads, fresh sandwiches. Someone's got to be there at that time to make a turkey chef salad or make a fresh fruit and cheese plate. So they come in and they start prepping those salads, sandwiches, hot food for the day. When you're serving 800 meals at the high school alone, it takes time to get all that food ready. So our staff are staggered to come in. They get in, they cook the food, they prep. They get fresh fruits and vegetables chopped up for our salad bars. They get food wrapped for our slider. Our drivers take food. They deliver the hot food. They deliver those cold salads and sandwiches that are on the menu for that day. And then we talk about lunch service. So we have people that are serving on our serving lines. We have people that are cashiering. So we have a variety, and we like to cross-train our employees so that they can all do all of that. And it takes a village, as they say, mm-hmm. to really make this happen. We have a head cook who cooks food for the high school, the middle school, the elementary schools. And then we have people who are cashiers, servers. Mm-hmm. After lunch service, we have approximately 2 hours worth of lunch service at our high school. At the elementary schools, that varies a little bit. The lunches are a little bit shorter. And then they have to clean up. We have dishes from all of our prep. We have dishes from all of our service. We have to cash out our registers. I mean, it's a long day, and there's a lot of different steps and moving mm-hmm. pieces in that process that people take for granted.
And the way you described all that, just thinking of that compared to a student holding a tray that has, you mm-hmm. know, some chicken and an apple, whatever, it really does shed light on the bigger operation behind it. And, you know, I've always found this intriguing when the debate over whether school funding should include paying for student lunches. Mm-hmm. I know it was a big deal through the pandemic. But most developed nations include food in their daily operation without mm-hmm. having to charge students.
Right.
And when you think about it, we don't charge students to ride a bus to school. In most places, we don't charge them to play sports or be in the school play or whatnot. Mm-hmm. It just seems interesting that we, as a culture, have a history of charging them for lunch, even though so many other services are part of, you know, the taxes that school districts collect and take care of children. And the way you explain that operational piece really is a good way to look at it. So, Allison, I appreciate your time joining us on School Talks. You've given us a lot to think about. And as always, keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after the break, we'll chat with Laura Smith and Kelly Johncox, bus drivers from Warren Consolidated Schools, on how they get the children to and from school every day. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Once again at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Laura Smith and Kelly Johncox from Warren Consolidated Schools, bus drivers in the district for many years. Welcome to the program, ladies.
Thank you.
So I think a good place to start, first and foremost, start with you, Laura. In your role as a bus driver, are there different types of buses or vehicles that you may have to drive any day of the week?
Just different lengths of buses. Uh-huh. We usually drive like either 40-foot or 30-foot buses.
And the 40-foot bus, do you often fit small children three to a seat?
They want to sit three to a seat, but we try not to let them
do that. Okay. So obviously, the shorter the bus, the fewer passengers and so on.
Correct.
Kelly, let me ask you, what safety measures do you take to ensure that kids are safe on the bus, especially when it's moving?
Well, in my experience, because I drive special needs and I also have driven regular ed, with the regular ed, you know, you just have to make sure when they come on and say, you know, guys, need you to take a seat. You know, I know it's, you know, if you're going home, it's they're all excited.
Sure.
You know, so I'm going to tell them, listen, laughter, talking, singing, I'm all good with that.
Yeah.
You just need to be in your seat and you stay out of the aisle way.
Is it fair to say they're more rambunctious going home than coming to school?
Absolutely.
100%.
Especially on the last day of school,
oh,
right?
Oh, the high school kids haven't had their coffee yet. So they're half asleep. So they're little zombies, actually. It's kind of funny.
In the same spirit of that, Laura, how do you handle disciplinary issues with students, especially while you're trying to maintain control of the bus?
Well, we have an indoor inside mic, so a microphone. So a lot of times you'll have to go on that. However, it seems like once you make eye contact in the mirror, they usually get it.
And that's the big mirror that sits above you.
Correct.
That you see behind you.
Yes.
That's fair. And obviously, with all the different traffic laws and things like that, there's a significant amount of responsibility on both of your shoulders to make sure children get to and from school every day.
Absolutely.
And I think it's one of those things, as we focus on the sort of the non-instructional elements that support schools, it is fundamentally one of the most important aspects of schools for children, is getting them to and from school safely. And like
right.
I said, it's one of those things, many people don't appreciate it until they start to see buses on the road in the fall.
Right.
But there is a lot of lot of love and prized commodity on those buses that you're all responsible for. And in that spirit of safety, Kelly, let me ask you, before you use a bus, do you go through a particular pre-trip inspection and or is there anything you have to do when you're over driving and the bus is back in the yard?
Well, absolutely. In the beginning, in the morning, when we first come in, we start our buses to make sure they do start. But we do, we have a checklist that we go through. We make sure that our lights are working properly. First and foremost, we do a brake test. You know, your horn, I mean, it's pretty extensive, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming back, you definitely want to, they call it, we have a child minder. So once we put our overhead lights on where that stop arm comes out,
mm-hmm.
once you use that and you turn it off, the child minder is set. So you can't even get off your bus without going to the back of the bus and shutting it off, which is basically for our safety and the children to make sure there is nobody left on that bus.
Oh, interesting.
So that's why it's called a child minder. So it's, you know, it's very helpful.
Yeah, it's it reminds me of those machines that in manufacturing that require you to have both hands on the safety thing before you actually enter the stamper or whatever it is manufacturing wise. It's like a double safe, so to speak.
Right.
Interesting, Laura. In the event of an emergency, God forbid an emergency on a bus, whether it's a health emergency, talk to us a little bit about what the protocols are for you, depending on the type of emergency. How do you connect with law enforcement or back to the transportation base? How does that unfold?
Yeah, we just radio back to base, and we let them know that there's an emergency and describe whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we pull over first, and then we call mm-hmm. base, and then we just let them make the phone calls. We
sure.
don't get on our phones and do any of that. We just keep the kids calm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're currently chatting with Laura Smith and Kelly Johncox, bus drivers for Warren Consolidated Schools. Let me follow up on that. Have you ever had the situation where, I imagine you have, given your service in driving, the EMS or someone has to come to the bus?
Yes.
Whether a student's ill or, God forbid, a driver is ill and so on. And that, certainly that, you mentioned talk back to the base.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some type of dispatch there?
Yes.
So there's a central dispatch, and they know where all the buses are and things
Absolutely.
Like that. Yeah. So that's interesting. Laura, one follow-up question. Right in the lane with safety, are there particular requirements of you officially, depending on the type of weather you're in terms of, I'll give you an example. If it's raining, are there particular speeds that you have to travel or snow, or is it just a judgment issue?
It's a judgment.
Just depending on the weather conditions.
Yeah, it's your best judgment.
And could you share with our listeners, one, why do buses stop at railroad crossings?
Oh, go for it, honey.
It's for the safety of our, the kids on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
We just make sure that there's no trains coming.
Yep.
But we have to stop at every single one.
Yep.
Even if we don't have kids on the bus, it's just a good practice.
And you know, for people listening, if you're not familiar with Warren, there's a lot of railroad tracks in Warren.
There truly is.
Yes.
And if you're on one of the mile roads and the train, most of the tracks run north-south, if you're on one of the mile roads 40 minutes before school starts, wherever you're going, it's going to take a little bit of time.
And usually it's at 14 and 15 mile at
sure.
the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I want to follow up, Kelly, you mentioned the safety arm and the child minder. I remember years ago, a slogan, this is before those arms would come out, and that the slogan was, if the lights are blinking up top, you stop. If they're blinking down low, you go slow. And I know that's different now. It's still the same, but the arm is now required by law, is it not?
Yes.
Because I don't see a bus now without the arm that says stop.
Right.
Another thing for either of you, maybe Laura, sometimes buses don't put the arm out on busy mile roads. Can you explain that?
That's a
district
policy. And it's speed limit law. So if it's above 55 miles an hour, we don't.
Okay.
But if it's below, we do.
So, and we do that basically just to not stop traffic.
Right.
You know what I mean? We keep the traffic flowing.
Right.
Right.
And it's normally the children that get off are usually high school students.
Mm-hmm.
There is
right
there middle school. I'm not sure about that.
Probably.
They do special needs, but we never, ever have the elementary schools get off.
And,
there.
You know, a road that has that high of a speed limit, children are typically not crossing that like a residential street.
Correct.
No.
So,
never.
So the need to stop traffic for crossing is not there. Because in my time as superintendent, I would get calls from time to time from people who say, the bus didn't stop, and they're on Mound and the speed limit's 55 miles an hour.
Right.
And we have to explain to them, they're really not crossing like they do in subdivisions. Kelly, one last thought. You mentioned that you transport special needs children. Can you share with us your experience in transporting them? And is there any special accommodations that are in place depending on the needs that they have?
For me, What I've been doing is with, there are children that are in car seats. So you have to definitely get them buckled and secured properly. We try to keep, with the special needs, in each row a child, not next to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's for their own safety as well. And then for the ones that are a little bit larger or older, we have seat belts. And I would like them to be up front so that I can keep an eye on them.
Yep. And and those buses are obviously typically shorter. So you're not looking 40 feet past in the back.
No. We have three different size buses, actually.
Sure.
We've got the 40, then we have what they call the midsize. I'm going to say maybe it's 35 feet because it's larger than the small bus, but it's smaller than the big bus.
Yeah. Yep.
But it's still a good size.
Right in the middle.
But it's still, either way, you're still being very cautious with the children.
Laura Smith and Kelly Johncox are bus drivers from Warren Consolidated Schools. Thanks so much for stopping by and giving us a look at what it means to transport our most precious commodities every day. It really is. And for all of our listeners, as you see the buses come out and start getting kids back to school in the fall, just remember Laura and Kelly are doing some of the most important work. And on that note, I want to thank you for stopping by. And as always, keep up the good work. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
After a short break to hear from our sponsors, we will chat with PTOtoday.com, a national organization dedicated to supporting parent-teacher groups and booster clubs all across the country. Stay tuned. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR. With Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now today on the program from PTOtoday.com are Carrie Bouchain, Director of Client Marketing and Content, and Julie Drummond, the Manager of Leadership Support. Welcome to the program, ladies.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I wanted to invite you on the show. In my experience, both as a school principal and as a superintendent for many years, one of the things that schools often struggle with, especially nowadays, is recruiting parents to get involved in school. And as I'm sure you would support, parental involvement is one of the key ingredients to a student's success. And I'm very familiar with the work of PTO Today. I've used your services for years. And on so many occasions, position many of our school PTOs to make good decisions. And on that, I wanted to give you an opportunity to share with us the kind of work you do and some up-and-coming things. And I'd like to start with Julie Drummond. How would you define the primary role of a parent-teacher organization in what we know as a modern school setting, and maybe how it's evolved over time?
Sure. Yeah. The primary role of a parent-teacher organization, or PTO, can also be known as other names like PTA, acronyms HSA, or booster group. It's to bring families and teachers and the school staff together to support all students. And it enhances their education and their overall school experience. You know, each parent group develops their own mission statement, I'd say, or purpose. But that's the heart of it, to support students at the school. And every decision that a group makes, it's guided by that mission statement. So where their time, their efforts, their funds all go. The mission stays the same, but year to year, how that's accomplished generally changes depending on what's going on at the school. Mm-hmm. That could be, you know, a growing or changing community population, or it could be budget issues. So if a parent group had been involved with or supported a program that had been impacted by those budget changes, it might fall within the group's mission to find a way to keep that program running.
Carrie Bouchain, Director of Client Marketing and Content, what do you think are some impactful ways that a PTO can help transform a school? Julie laid out a nice understanding of sort of what the supports are that make it happen. But at the school level, what are some of your experiences as to how a PTO can really transform a school from just, you know, being a school in the neighborhood to a true community partner, so to speak?
PTOs are really at their best when they're able to turn a school into a real community, and that starts by making all families feel welcome, which is so simple, right? it's super important for a PTO to remember that a school community is the sum of its parts. So PTO leaders really need to be intentional when it comes to meeting the unique needs of their community. So start with your PTO meetings. Try switching up times so that more working parents are able to attend. Bring in a translator so that everyone's able to follow along and participate. And when your PTO is planning events, think about ways you can make every student feel included. For example, some PTOs will form a planning committee made up of special ed teachers and parents, which is a simple step that honestly makes such a big difference to so many families. Personally speaking, I'm a mom of neurodivergent kids, and honestly, I have to say when a PTO puts in this kind of effort, it goes such a long way. So also making sure kids with disabilities can take part in all events and activities. For example, sensory-friendly events like a silent disco, adapting field day games so everyone's able to participate, making an effort to celebrate all the different cultures in your community with a school multicultural night where families get the chance to highlight what makes their culture awesome.
We're currently chatting with Carrie Bouchain and Julie Drummond from PTO Today, a really, I think, successful organization that supports PTOs and parent groups across the country. And Carrie, I wanted to follow up. I did some research in preparation for today, and could you tell us a little bit about the Starkey Ranch K-8 school and some of the really neat things that they have done that I think is in part to what you're talking about?
Absolutely. So this is one of my favorite stories that we highlighted recently. Starkey Ranch from Odessa, Florida. So it was 2021. Everyone was coming out of the fog of the pandemic. And Bridget McEwen, a full-time working mom of three kids, she had just moved to the community and the school had just opened. Previously, she was at a Title I school where she saw the power of involved parents firsthand. And she really wanted to bring that same spirit of community to her new school. So this is a really impressive story. In just 3 weeks, she and a few other parents created a PTO, wrote bylaws, got a mascot, and this part's amazing. Within a few months, they recruited 75 local businesses to support the school through a partner program. Their first fundraiser was a reading pledge drive, and they raised over $120,000. Which is truly incredible for any group, right? But it also got the entire school community excited around a common goal. Since then, they've raised more than $600,000. They've been able to fund things like student technology, classroom grants, playground shade structures, and even an outreach program to help other schools in need. They created new traditions like a welcome breakfast for teachers, a sock hop. These experiences really help Starkey Ranch build a strong, inclusive culture.
Let me ask, what state is Starkey Ranch in? I don't know if you mentioned that.
They're in Florida, Odessa, Florida.
Okay, just for our School Talks listeners, we talk about a K-8 system. In Michigan, most school districts are pre-K-12. In other states, they're divided differently. Some districts in Florida might only be K-8. I know in Illinois, you could just have a high school district, so to speak. So just wanted to provide some clarity to that. Ladies, I need to take a short break to hear from our sponsors. When I come back, though, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the strategies you found most effective in increasing parent involvement. This is a great example from Starkey Ranch. So if you'll stay right there, we'll be back right after this. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Welcome back to School Talks. We're currently chatting with Carrie Bouchane and Julie Drummond from PTO Today. Our focus today is really working toward getting more and more parents involved in PTOs and really involvement in the school to help build the community. And before the break, we were talking about a really neat success story about a district in Florida. And Carrie, I want to follow up. How can a school and a PTO make new families feel welcome and motivated to participate from the moment they come to the school? In your experience, what are some thoughts on that?
Honestly, it all starts with breaking down barriers and making families feel like they belong from day one. Take your open house, for example. Many PTOs will have a strong presence at those back-to-school events to introduce their group, say hi, hand out welcome packets, school swag. Some PTOs will even set up ambassador families where they pair new families with a buddy family, or host simple, fun meetups at back to school, like popsicles on the playground. Those kind of small efforts go a really long way and make the PTO the bridge that helps families feel connected to the school. One back to school event idea that I really love, I have to share with your listeners. It's a kindergarten signing day. So this is a fun, low-key kickoff where new families come in, they meet each other in the PTO, and they really feel like they're part of the school community before the year even starts. And new kindergarten students get to sign a certificate. So it's just a super cute event. It's a great photo op for families and a great way for them to get to know each other. Just in general, you want to make sure your PTO has some sort of a presence at all the big school events, whether that's open house or meet the teacher night. And honestly, this is a big one. You want to put QR codes on everything, literally. It makes it so easy for parents to quickly sign up for things or to learn more. And this goes back to being inclusive, but if your PTO is trying to engage Spanish-speaking families in the community, you know, have QR codes in both English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. At PTO meetings, you want to have name tags, greeters, icebreakers, stuff like that to make new parents feel comfortable. And when it comes to motivating new parents to volunteer, remember to start small. This is super important. You don't want to make new parents feel overwhelmed at the start of the school year when everything's already crazy and chaotic. Most parents are already tapped out after buying school supplies, right? So when you do go looking for ways to get parents to help, offer those easy bite-sized tasks. This takes the pressure off and allows parents to get involved on their own terms. Mm-hmm. So the takeaways here are just to be inclusive and to keep things fun and low stress so that families actually want to show up for your PTO and stick around.
I like your reference to having lots of people help out, because there's an old saying in my family that many hands make light work. And
yes.
A question for you, Julie. How can a PTO ensure that the work they do benefits the needs of all the families in the community, and maybe not just those parents who are already sort of perceived as highly engaged?
Yes, yes. I'm going to echo Carrie here, which is build a school community that is inclusive of all families and reflects their voices. To be truly integrated, you'd want to have board members that represent all of the families with students at your school. But a great start is to designate liaisons or advocates for those communities you want to attract and engage with. That can represent different languages or cultures or even neighborhoods that you want to reach out to and personally welcome and connect with those families.
We're currently chatting with Julie Drummond and Carrie Bouchane from PTO Today. Julie, I want to follow up on one very specific thing you said and see what your thought is on this. I've known over the years that many PTOs who are really active and do lots of great things at the school sometimes are misunderstood by other parents who believe they don't have to get involved because this group has it covered. And I'm just, based on what you said in terms of all the neat creative ways to engage them, any thoughts on how a PTO could and should not forget that even though you're busy, it's important not to lead people to believe that everything is handled?
Right, right. Well, I think Carrie has a lot of experience with this, which is, you know, people think that someone else is doing it. So, you know, they've got it covered, or that someone else will step up. But that personal connection is what is so critical. And a lot of people don't even understand what a parent group does. So, you know, be sure to showcase what the efforts of the group do to benefit their children, that the group funds field trips that the kids get to go on, that they put on the carnival that the family had a lot of fun at, or they clean up the playground, give the student's teacher extra supplies for their classroom. studies show that kids with involved parents do better in school, mm-hmm. and involvement shows kids that education is important. So school becomes this shared priority, and that supports student success, and involvement follows.
Mm-hmm. One final question for Carrie, if I could. Given all that we've talked about in terms of events and coordination and support and that, how do PTOs best balance their role between fundraising, you know, coordinating the fun run and offering direct support to teachers and students while keeping parent involvement at the heart of their mission?
Having a mission statement really allows your PTO to define your why, and helps all your board members focus, where to allocate your time, energy, and volunteers. And it's important that all board members get the chance to provide input around what the mission statement really is and to be intentional about it. And also, your board needs to regularly evaluate what you're doing to make sure it aligns with your mission. Make sure your PTO regularly gets input from parents, teachers, and admin, too. You want to make sure your efforts are aligned with what your school community needs, whether that's funding a new playground, hosting a multicultural night, a STEM night, et cetera. PTOs do juggle a lot, as you said, fundraising, school events, teacher appreciation. So initiatives that combine multiple missions are a win-win. So think about a fall festival that raises money and it brings families together for a night of fun. A book vending machine that promotes literacy and gets kids excited to read. Also, I mentioned this, before, but there's that whole concept of low pressure, high impact tasks. I like to call that concept micro volunteering. So flexibility is key. Break jobs into small, manageable chunks and offer parents in-person and at-home roles. And finally, keep parents in the loop about how the PTO and volunteers contribute to the bigger picture. For example, create a year in review and show everything your PTO did, the funds you raised, and how they were used. When parents see how their contributions directly benefit their kids, other students, and teachers, they're motivated to help even more.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
Honestly,
so.
Parent involvement is such a game changer. When families are plugged into the school, it builds a stronger connection between the home and the classroom. And the impact on kids is huge, as Julie said.
Outstanding. Carrie Bouchain and Julie Drummond from PTO Today. For our School Talks listeners, if you visit ptotoday.com, there is a wealth of resources there. Pretty much everything that we've discussed and anything you could imagine that you would need for a PTO. As I said at the start of this, I relied on your site for many, many years as both a principal and a superintendent to help our parents navigate. I want to thank you for joining us on School Talks, and as always, keep up the good work.
Thanks so much for having us.
With schools underway across this great state, I want to thank our guests, Allison Sayre from Fraser Public Schools, Laura Smith and Kelly Johncox from Warren Consolidated Schools, and Julie Drummond and Carrie Bouchain from PTOtoday.com. That is all the time we have for today, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this is School Talks on 760 WJR.